Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
For sale this week, $115 billion in brand new AAA-rated U.S. government debt. Willing buyers should have ready cash and a robust trading relationship with the United States. Being in Washington this week would help, too. Convenient. There's a big Chinese delegation here, I guess, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday today, the 27th of July. Great to have you here. Of course, the Chinese aren't the only ones who buy U.S. government debt, but they do hold a huge chunk of it. With the Treasury Department having to finance bailouts and stimulus package, the Obama administration is hoping Beijing will add to its purchases. That makes the talks that got started in Washington today between the world's biggest and one of the world's fastest growing economies all the more important. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
China is responsible for more than 80% of the U.S. trade deficit, not counting oil. And President Obama says there's a way to use the recession to shrink that imbalance.
As Americans save more and Chinese are able to spend more, we can put growth on a more sustainable foundation. Because just as China has benefited from substantial investment and profitable exports, China can also be an enormous market for American goods.
To realize that potential, Aaron Ennis at the U.S.-China Business Council says American negotiators need only remind the Chinese of their dependence on the global economy.
I don't think that any of China's leaders have lost the point that while the discussion about a year ago was about whether China would be able to weather this recession better than anybody else because they had insulated themselves from it, the answer to that clearly was no.
But China's representatives bring their own agenda. They want assurances that U.S. government efforts to spend its way out of the recession won't hurt China's investments in U.S. treasuries. Stephen Schrage of the Center for Strategic and International Studies says China is exercising more economic muscle in its relations with the U.S.
It started out as the U.S. really kind of lecturing China. Now China is sending shots across the bow with the United States saying, well, we're not sure that your currency is going to be stable in the years ahead. So there has been more of that push and pull, which I think is more reflective of a mature relationship.
Mature and more complex, he adds. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
By way of introduction to today's next item, a poll result. The Gallup organization says the Federal Reserve came up dead last in a survey of consumer confidence in 9 different government agencies. Perhaps that explains why Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke is taking his case directly to the American people. The NewsHour on PBS taped a town hall with Mr. Bernanke this weekend, complete with questions from the audience. There was a glimpse of the personal side during the start of the financial crisis last fall.
And those were some very long nights I spent on the sofa in my office as we worked to try to keep the financial system running.
And questions about the bailouts, too.
Nothing made me more frustrated, more angry, than having to intervene, particularly in a couple of cases where taking wild bets had forced these companies close to bankruptcy. There's nothing made me angrier than having to do that. Why do we do it? Because if that company had collapsed in the middle of a crisis, it could have brought everything down.
You can see the whole thing tonight through Wednesday on the NewsHour on PBS. As tough as Mr. Bernanke's had it in dealing with the U.S. economy this year, I bet he's thankful he doesn't run Iceland's central bank. 2008 was all about banks there imploding and the national economic model being turned upside down. But there was some good news today. Iceland cleared the first hurdle on the road to membership in the European Union. But as our European correspondent Stephen Beard reports now, it could be a long road.
The hurricane that hit Iceland's economy last year has sent people scurrying for shelter. Benedikt Johansson is a magazine publisher. He says the krona has halved in value, living standards have slumped. Many Icelandic politicians are looking enviously at the safety of the euro.
People see that it's almost impossible for a small nation like us to have our own currency. People are thinking more about taking up the euro, and that can only be done by applying for membership of the European Union.
The EU says that Iceland will have to wait its turn behind other applicant countries, but Dragana Ignatovic of IHS Global Insight says Iceland should qualify quicker than Turkey or Balkan countries like Serbia.
Issues such as democratic transition, which the Balkan countries and Turkey are still struggling with very much, and human rights, are not an issue for Iceland.
But she warns Icelanders have always resisted membership in the past, fearing they'd have to surrender control over their most prized resource, fish.
One of the major issues for the government right now will be winning over the fishermen to the idea of membership, because since the virtual economic collapse, fishing is once again Iceland's biggest industry.
Icelanders will decide whether to join in a referendum in 2 or 3 years' time. Everything will then depend on the argument about fish and whether the economy has recovered and whether the country still feels the need for a safe haven. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Back on this side of the Atlantic Ocean on Wall Street today, all three major indices squeaked out a win. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Consumer electronics can be a brutal business. Narrow profit margins, tough online competition, not to mention all those discounts, and more discounts. Some national chains have folded, Circuit City probably the best known. But today, Radio Shack reported its profits rose 18% from a year ago. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch explains how they pulled it off.
Radio Shack's been around so long, some say it feels like a relic from the 90s. John Leposky is managing editor of Twice, a consumer electronics industry newsletter.
By the general public, they are seen as kind of out of date, behind the times. They're not big and flashy.
So why has Radio Shack survived while others have fallen? Part of the answer is the company's ubiquity. 4,500 stores, 1,400 dealer outlets, and 600 cell phone kiosks.
They're a little bit like the McDonald's of technology retail.
That's consumer analyst Carl Howe with the Yankee Group.
They don't have the fanciest things. They don't have the highest end models. But they do have something that a lot of people will buy.
Radio Shack also has been ruthless about cutting costs and closing underperforming stores. The chain was profitable this past quarter, not because its sales are up, but because its expenses are way down. Analyst Paul Nolte with Hinsdale Associates says Radio Shack has cornered a consumer niche, the do-it-yourselfer.
A Best Buy or Circuit City is, let me buy everything and be done with it, as opposed to, you know, I need a couple replacement parts, can't find it anywhere. And Radio Shack is the place to go to find some of that stuff.
Radio Shack sees its future in wireless accessories and services. Last week, it inked a deal with T-Mobile to start selling their phones. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
There are some things that no matter how bad the economy, you just have to get them fixed when they break. Fertile ground for the last installment of our series, The Upside, about businesses thriving in a recession. So what do you do when your dishwasher stops washing or your dryer stops tumbling? All-Star Appliance owner Dave Corsandi's phone is ringing off the hook.
All-Star Appliance.
My name is David Corsandi, owner-operator of All-Star Appliance Repair Incorporated. We're based out of Oak Park, Agoura Hills area of Southern California. We provide service, repair, maintenance for all major appliances, items such as washers, dryers, refrigerators, ovens, microwaves.
I'm Mary Lechman, and I called Dave in to repair our ice machine and our Sub-Zero refrigerator. I'm sure there's a lot more people looking for repairs than for purchases.
November of 08 was the largest month gross-wise that I've had ever. The economy is definitely part of the equation. I think that has put people a little bit more like, let's just fix this instead of replace it immediately like they used to think.
Hello.
There she is.
My name is Susan Guy, and I called Dave because we had him out last time to see our washing machine. And with, you know, two kids and no washing machine, that can be really bad. I did ask him, is this dryer good enough to spend the money to get a replacement part? And he said it was, and you know, it was worth saving.
It's a very exciting time to see how the trend has changed and how people are looking at things differently. It's actually nice to see that people aren't throwing everything away as much.
David Corsandi of All-Star Appliances out in Agora Hills. That's northwest of downtown Los Angeles. The whole series, The Upside, is on our website. It's marketplace.org. We're doing summer reading with a financial twist this year. Today, the latest novel from the English writer Ian Pears. Stones Fall, it's called. It opens in 1950s Paris. It moves through time with bank failures and arms deals, and it runs headlong into the ruins of the title's deceitful main character, John Stone. Mr. Pears, good to have you with us.
Hi.
A lot of what happens in this book, the deceit and the credit problems and the high finance, it sounds scarily ripped from today's headlines, even though it's set many, many years ago.
No, I prefer to think that the today's headlines were ripped scarily from my book. I started writing the book about 3-4 years ago, because what I like to do when I write these historical novels is write about things which no one else is really interested in and try to make them interesting. So I cast around for something which would be entirely irrelevant to the modern age. I thought that a banking crisis would be just the thing.
Had we only known what you know, right?
Yes, and had I only known what I know, because I could have spent my time shorting bank stocks rather than writing a novel, which would probably have been more lucrative. But
so after 4 years of immersing yourself in Victorian high finance and banking, is it your sense that not much has changed in the past 120 years?
Well, quite a lot has changed in some ways because, I mean, the banks, you know, the bank I was writing about, Barings, was a partnership. So the partners were personally liable for the losses. When Barings went down the drain, everything of the family was sold. And so the family actually suffered, which meant that the banking community as a whole was relatively immune because the bankers who caused this trouble were seen to have suffered as well. People didn't sort of resent it so much.
As fits a good Victorian novel, there is lying and deceit and misleading and all kinds of things in this book, which would seem to run counter to the notion of what it takes to make a banking system succeed, which is trust and confidence. And it seems that happens today as well.
Well, I mean, in the, you know, the 19th century, really up until the 1970s, you know, the City of London had this this notion that a gentleman's word is his bond. You could give your word and that was good enough. And to a certain extent, that did apply. You know, if a banker said, you know, I will pay you sort of £100,000 next Tuesday, that was considered to be a legal contract. But that aside, I mean, the double dealing and deceit was just as great then as it is now. I think it's just that the sums are larger now. And also in the book, everybody acts in rather dubious ways, but in some ways they're not. You know, they're being relatively open about being deceitful, which sort of makes it somehow better, I think.
It's still tricky to run a banking system when people are being honest about lying or lying about being honest.
Well, as long as everybody knows what the rules are, it works. It's when people break the rules, which is the trouble.
What's the lesson then after 550 pages of this book and the last 3 years of the financial crisis in this world?
You know, it's that if trouble can happen, it will. And if you get caught in it to a certain extent, you can't say you haven't been warned. And it's a fairly obvious lesson, but just that sooner or later this is going to happen again as well.
And you can bank on that. I mean, you clearly were with this novel.
Well, I did a little work on other financial crises as well. And, the banking crises turn up every 30 years. I mean, in England, at least, anyway, it's the banking system gets hit. It takes 10 years to recover. It takes 10 years to be respectable. Then it takes another 10 years to get above itself. And then, bang, it all blows up again.
Ian Pears, his most recent novel, this one about high finance and misbehavior, is called Stones Fall. Mr. Pears, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, life after foreclosure.
It's really hard to see, I'm sure, to see your parents go from a house into a your motorhome and in a park.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials picked up just 15 points, a little less than 0.2%, closed at 9,108 today. The NASDAQ added about 2 points, 0.1%, finished at 1967. The S&P 500 inched up almost 3 points, 0.3%, wrapped up the day at 982. Investors felt a little queasy after health insurer Aetna announced second quarter profits fell by 20 cents a share. The stock closed down nearly 3% today. Traders also called in the sell orders for Verizon after the telecom giant dialed in a second quarter earnings 21% lower. Shares closed down almost 2% today. Wall Street apparently was not tuned into those results from Radio Shack we told you about earlier. Shares fell nearly 7% today. On the bright side, the folks at Taser International unveiled their newest stun gun today. This one can shock up to three people without a reload. Shares rose nearly 0.75% on that news. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.72%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. We've got all the business news worth talking about on our new blog. Scott Jagow hosts the Marketplace Scratchpad. You can check in with him throughout the trading day at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index, letting us know how we all feel about spending money. On Capitol Hill, the Joint Economic Committee digs deeper into foreclosures and what more can be done to keep people in their homes. And the Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee holds a hearing to discuss national hurricane research. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today was a mercifully quiet day in Washington's healthcare debate. The conversation about costs and coverage will no doubt begin again tomorrow. In the meanwhile, today the journal Health Affairs put a price tag on one of the most expensive medical issues out there. Obesity-related problems now account for nearly 10% of U.S. healthcare spending, $147 billion a year. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
Dr. Stephen Middleman treats obesity at Children's Hospital in Los Angeles. He says the patients are getting younger all the time.
We're seeing toddlers and babies even that are overweight, and we don't even know what the implications of that is going to be.
According to this study, the obesity rate in the U.S. shot up 37% between 1998 and 2006. Just to be clear, we're using the government's definition of obesity, a 5'9" adult weighing over 203 pounds, for example. Health economist Eric Finkelstein at RTI International helped conduct this research. He says our love of cheap fast food isn't the only problem.
In our leisure time, physical activity now has to compete against a whole host of new, pretty cool sedentary activities like the internet and computer games and so on.
Healthcare spending now averages $1,400 more a year for obese patients. That includes the cost of drugs for everything from diabetes to high blood pressure. Finkelstein says the U.S. will never tackle rising healthcare costs unless it treats its collective weight problem. He says their research shows cash incentives may help.
We published a paper that shows if you pay individuals $7 a pound, you can get the type of weight loss that's traditionally seen through off-the-shelf weight loss programs.
In fact, the Senate health care bill contains a measure that gives workers potentially huge discounts on their insurance premiums if they lose weight or participate in other wellness programs. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
There was some better-than-usual news about the housing market today. New home sales rose last month. The number of houses hanging around out there on the market fell. Those are both good things. but they're not going to do much to change the damage that the real estate market did on the way down. Millions of people have lost their homes to foreclosure, and we've heard a lot of those stories. What we don't hear so much about is what happens after foreclosure to the people who lost the house and to the house they lost. So we sent Chrissy Clark from American Radio Works to Las Vegas.
You've probably never been to Broxburn Street in Las Vegas, but you've seen places like it. When I first visited 6 months ago, Broxburn was just another half-empty street in what was becoming a suburban ghost town. A ghost burb, I guess you'd call it. Empty stucco houses, brown lawns, a row of signs that said, for sale, bank owned, and...
Smell it?
A terrible stink.
It's just a very distinctive, like, algae, you know?
Algae, rotting leaves, a drowned bird. The smell was coming from three filthy swimming pools in the backyards of three foreclosed homes right next to each other. I was with a guy named Rob Cole. His job is to clean pools that have been abandoned.
More things living in that pool than the house. A lot more.
But there are traces of the people who used to live here. A birdhouse nailed to a tree, the ruins of a rock-lined fish pond. And looking through a window into the living room of 3613 Broxburn.
Wow, look at what it says there.
Wow, that's really sad.
There's a message spray-painted in neat black letters on one of the walls.
After 15 years here, thanks.
So what happened to the family who spray-painted this message once they moved out? And what happened to the house they left behind?
Hi,
how are you?
I found the answer to the first question a few miles away from suburban Broxburn Street, but also a world away, at the Oasis RV Park in lot 652. A woman with bleach blonde hair is sitting in a lawn chair, holding a Coca-Cola glass full of pink wine.
I'm a little nervous. I've had two glasses of wine, but I have iced tea for you.
That's Kimberly Teal. She and her husband, Mike, are both in their 50s. They used to own the house at 3613 Broxburn. Kim spray-painted the message on the wall right before they left. She gets emotional just talking about it.
I want the new owners to know, look, this is my home. Take care of it.
Now Kim and Mike have a new home, a 25-foot motor home.
This is where we live. Now, this used to be our party rig, okay?
The tour of the party rig doesn't take long. It's just one room, plus a toilet in the closet and a nook in the back for the bed.
I gutted it all out, put all new wallpaper in, and
it's home.
They've barely finished showing me their new home before they turn to memories of their old one, the only one they ever owned, where they lived with their two daughters and their aging parents.
Happy Thanksgiving!
Happy Thanksgiving.
Mike puts on this home movie from Thanksgiving a few years ago.
And this is our turkey this year. Looks kind of good. And you like
Kim can't take her eyes off the screen where her smiling relatives flicker by.
You've got a beautiful home here. I used to have a nice house, huh? Look at it.
Yeah, we did it all ourselves, just her and I. Redid all the cupboards, put all new appliances in. Redid the floor. Everything in there is all brand new. For somebody else.
For somebody else.
The Teals lost their home in a way that's become painfully familiar. They refinanced for the second time at the peak of the real estate boom to an adjustable rate mortgage. But they didn't read the fine print about how much the interest rate would rise after a few years. Once it did rise...
I actually read the fine paperwork and we got screwed.
They couldn't afford it. Kim was at home full-time taking care of their sick parents. One had Alzheimer's, another cancer. And as hard as they tried to stretch Mike's income as a slot machine repairman, it just wasn't enough to cover the mortgage. Finally, last November, the bank gave them 3 days to get out. So Mike and Kim moved into their motorhome. Not long before, both their elderly parents had passed away, and their older daughter had already moved out of the house. But their younger daughter had just graduated from high school and was still living at home. Now, she's couch surfing with friends.
You know what that does to my heart? I've worked my whole freaking life to make sure my kids had everything. And now the whole family is all...
They're all over the place.
They're everywhere because they haven't got a centering point.
It's really hard to see, I'm sure, to see your parents go from a house into your motorhome and in a park.
You know how they treat you at work? Tell her that. Trailer trash.
Oh, yeah, they call me trailer trash. I'm sure they don't mean any harm in it. They're, you know, it's just a joke to them, but it's not a joke to me.
And it's hard to forget the home they used to have. The Teals haven't gone back to their home on Broxburn Street, but I have. To see what life after foreclosure has been like for the house.
I'm standing in front of the house. Looks like somebody has moved in.
There were moving boxes stacked on the front porch. Three dogs barked at me through the door. A woman in her 50s, named Carrie Michelle Reeves, bought the house in April with cash for $120,000. That's $10,000 less than it cost when the Teals bought it 15 years ago. Reeves didn't want to talk on tape about how she'd benefited from someone else's misfortune, but she did let me come inside and see the house. She's gutted the place, knocked down walls, repainted everything, including the spray-painted message that said, "After 15 years here, thanks." I asked her how she felt about that message that the Teals had left, and she said, "I feel sad for them, but they made bad decisions. Their loss is my gain."
Okay, this is our local bathroom, right? Now, you think I'm a weirdo? Come on in here.
Kim Teal is taking me past rows of motorhomes to the public bathroom at the Oasis RV park. This has become her refuge.
If you turn this on, steam, and you sit in here and put your music on, okay? Now you're going to do yourself all in salt and olive oil, okay? And you're going to dye your hair, because you can't do it in the rig.
When she's not giving herself spa treatments in the public bathroom, Kim is busy looking for a job. It's hard in this economy, but not as urgent. Now that the Teals don't have a mortgage, the income that they do have goes further, and they can spend it on things they couldn't when they owned the house on Broxburn Street.
Fixing her teeth up.
I got a lot of money in my teeth.
So there was things that we let lag behind, like going to the doctor for skin cancer that I have.
But you have to have co-payments, you know, and it's like we didn't have that. We wouldn't even think about that. But it's now that we are taking care of ourselves a little bit better now.
Kim's gotten into photography recently, and she shows me a picture she took on her cell phone from the door of their motorhome.
Oh, look at this.
One of those perfect sunsets with the light streaming through the clouds.
I mean, if you have to go to bed every single night and look at this, can't be that bad, can it?
In Las Vegas, I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
For more of our coverage of how this recession is reshaping people's lives, go to marketplace.org. Click on that link that says The Big Shift.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, Ben Bernanke is sometimes treated as economic royalty, but he has nothing at all on the Queen of England. From London's Observer newspaper comes this item. Last November, Her Majesty paid a visit to the London School of Economics. While there, she apparently asked why nobody there had anticipated the financial crisis. Wishful thinking combined with hubris was the substance of a 3-page letter the Queen got in response. Seems to me her former colonies could have told her that from over here. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow rose 15 points, a little less than 0.2%. The Nasdaq added 2 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 bumped up 3 points, 0.3%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abeed. Coming up next time on this program, renewable energy for locals only.
I think there is a rising level of what you might call buy China feeling in this market.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.